Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. In this sports interview, I will visit with Don Ray, president of the PGA of America, about this year's PGA Championship, which took place at Quail Hollow in Charlotte, North Carolina, and about the issues in golf impacting the 31,000 golf pros he represents. I'll also talk to Dr. Jeff Poblarski, the performance and recovery director at 7 USGA championships this summer, about what the USGA makes available to the competitors and to caddies at the U.S. Women's Open, the U.S. Open, and all the USGA championships. And to Nicholas Callaway, co-editor and co-publisher of The Unconquerable Game, Eli Callaway on the game of golf, business, and life. Nicholas Callaway completed his father Illy's memoir. Illy founded Callaway Golf at the age of 63. I think you'll really enjoy the book and my conversation with Nicholas Callaway. I hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. And it is my pleasure to say hello to Don Ray, the 44th president of the PGA of America. And Don is a member of the Southwest PGA section and is the owner and operator of Augusta Ranch Golf Club, a public golf course in Mesa, Arizona. And, you know, presidents of the PGA serve two-year terms and represent over 31,000 PGA golf professionals. It's a huge job. And we say hello to Don.
And it's my pleasure to be here. You're right, 31,000, but they seem to be all happy right now. So let's not ruin that. They're doing great things out there. It's awesome.
It is really great year for golf. Just so exciting, and for the PGA of America, with heightened interest in the game, a variety of stars, Don, who are capable of making history, and a Ryder Cup year as well. So what a year for the PGA.
You know, you're exactly right. I mean, hey, I got 31,000 stars, right? They're on the front lines out there sticking tees in the ground, hoping people get it airborne. And you're right. The recreational game is amazing, right? 28.1 million golfers. We got 47.2 are playing on and off the golf course. And then you're right. This is a major week. And we've got the strongest field of all the majors, 99 out of the top 100 players. So we're super excited to see what happens. And I tell everybody, you can't be the best unless you beat the best. And the best are here.
You're absolutely right. You're at Quail Hollow, and I mean, so many compelling stories. We have Rory. Can he continue his historic run? We have Jordan Spieth. He needs a title at the PGA Championship to capture a career Grand Slam. You have Xander Schauffele, who was the 2024 PGA Champion and Open Champion. What an incredible year he's had. And then Scottie Scheffler, of course. He doesn't have a PGA Championship yet. Two Masters titles, Bryson DeChambeau, two-time U.S. Open champion and came in second last year at the PGA Championship, JT, two-time PGA Championship, Brooks Koepka, three-time PGA champion. I mean, Don, the storylines are incredible.
Isn't it amazing, too? You know, and I love the fact, even like Rory's story, all the non-golfers who got involved in his story. And golfers had to explain why it was so emotional for Rory. And it gave an opportunity for a dad or mom who loves golf to explain to their family why they were crying, right, or why they were high-fiving. And it was so exciting. And I think when you have storylines like that, and these are really good individuals, too, it's just easy to kind of go, wow, I hope that person wins or that person wins. And that's what makes you excited to watch a four-day major championship. And you're right. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, we hand out the trophy later today, but I do know this. It's going to be exciting, and it's going to be must-see TV.
Well, talk about what makes the PGA Championship so different from the other majors.
Well, I think one, it's the strength of field, right? 99 out of the top 100. We love that. We have our Corebridge Financial 20. And so that's PGA professionals from across the country who play in our PGA Professional Championship in the top 20, the Corebridge Financial 20. They get to play in this event. So it's a huge week for all of us rooting on our fellow golf professionals. One, we have Carey Hay again. I mean, Carey, he's like the course whisperer. I don't know how he pulls it out of each layout, but everywhere that we go, he always makes it a compelling championship that identifies the best player that week. And I think it's the variety of golf courses, right? Some majors always stick at the certain time of golf courses, or they take a golf course and maybe they try to do a certain, you know, format out under shooting for a score. Carey's never done that. We go to different style facilities around the nation, and then he somehow, whatever the grasses are, whatever the tree situation is, he just seems to pick the right tee boxes, the right hole locations, and the right height of cut on all the grass. And it ends up just working every year. He never lets us down, Ann.
And the challenge is, of course, this week with all the rain. I mean, that's just so challenging for somebody like Carey.
Well, yeah, I mean, but this course is made for championships. It drains very well. We had a lot of rain this week, right? But if you look at the rough, it's growing. The fairways are perfect. I've been on the board for 3 years. I've been an officer now for four. I've been president for 6 months. This is the best conditioned golf course that I've seen in my travels. And we've had some amazing golf courses, but the sub-air systems they have out here, Keith Wood, who's their director of agronomy. Yeah, it's the rain's here, but I'll tell you what, it's just going to make it more compelling. So I can't wait to see what happens.
And you mentioned the 20 club pros, and I love that aspect of the PGA Championship. We had Dylan Newman on last week's show, the assistant pro at Meadowbrook on Long Island, who qualified for a second PGA Championship. That's a very special aspect of this major, Don, because these club pros who don't really play a ton of tournament golf because they're working day to day, right, at their clubs, they have a chance to really play with the best players in the world.
Isn't that great? I mean, there's professional golfers and there's golf professionals, and we are golf professionals and we still love to play and compete, but we've got a day job. And so we've got to do that all the time. But like Tyler Collette, you know, I just love what he's doing. You know, he wins the championship by 10 shots. I mean, it was a great win. You have Michael Block. This is his seventh PGA championship. Everybody knows the Block party that happened a couple years ago, you know, and then Bob Sowards, you know, 56 years old playing in this. But then I see a story like Rube Taylor. I don't know if you saw that story on Golf Digest, Ann, but Rube Taylor, you know, he had a lot of adversity in his life, was arrested, but he turned his life around. Now he's married. He's got a young baby, and then he makes it into the PGA Championship, being one of the team of 20. So proud of him and proud of the 20 they're going to play this week. I know they're going to represent us all very well.
Don, let's dive into some key issues facing golf today. There were a total of 16 LIV golfers entered into the field of this PGA Championship. Would you like to see the LIV golfers compete in PGA Tour events?
Well, you know, I don't control the PGA Tour. I'm just the PGA of America. And what we want is the strongest field in golf. We want the best players globally, not just here in the States, globally to play. And I think that's some of the secret sauce of Carey Hay also, right? We definitely have the systems that we go through, all the different tours that Carey looks at to find out and make sure we have the best players of the 156 that are here. I love it that, you know, the LIV players are only basically playing in some of these majors because it brings more people to watch Bryson and see what he can do. You're right. He just barely missed last year when Xander made that 6-foot putt. The first winner, by the way, who made a birdie on the last hole in like 20 years. And so I say, whether it's the Ryder Cup, the PGA Championship, or any of the majors we do on all the tours, we want the best in the world playing. And that's what we ensure that we get. And all we have to do is invite them. They show up.
And what about the official world golf rankings? Do you think they should award points to LIV golf players?
You know, I don't know. You know, Derek Sprague is our CEO. He sits on that board now. Obviously, Carey Hake sits on that board. So I just kind of stay in my lane, Ann, right? I'm the president. I stick to the 31,000. Derek and I work hand in hand. I know he's representing us well. And I'm not certain of the discussions that they're having about the world golf rankings, but I know Derek is going to represent golf. It's not just represent the PGA of America. He and I and the 31,000, we just want to win for golf whenever it happens. And if the golf wins, the PGA wins. And so, yeah, I don't know what they're going to end up figuring out, but I know they're thinking long and hard about all the things that impact our game.
Maybe it will be President Trump who brings the two sides together. You never know.
Well, you know, hey, I'm glad that he plays golf, right? I mean, it doesn't matter who you vote for. All I say is, that guy play golf? He does. Now you could play it, but not truly appreciate the power of golf. You know, golf raises more money for charity than all the other sports combined. And then when you look at what we do with PGA Reach, our foundation, right? The PGA Reach Foundation. There's three, and I know you know this, Ann, there's three pillars of that. One is PGA Works, and we just had the PGA Works Collegiate Championship at Whistling Straits, right? 180 athletes from all the HBCU universities, the minority-serving institutions, historical black colleges and universities, right, the HBCUs. So that's really cool. We have our HOPE program. This last Monday of this championship week, and was the Secretary's Cup, 12 teams of veterans all around the nation played in their major, their veterans major. We call it the Secretary Cup. And then PGA Junior League, right? 77,000 kids last year, numbers on their backs, boys and girls playing together. And that's what golf does. So if a president understands that, I know I understand it as president. You're president too, by the way. If we all understand that actually it's not what the money is, it's what the money does, then golf wins.
Well said, Don. Very well said. All right, let's look at the roll back the ball issue, because I know you all talked about that in the press conference earlier in the week. You and the CEO of the PGA of America, Derek Sprague, reiterated at the press conference that the PGA is against rolling back the golf ball, which aims to make golf balls go less of a distance than they currently do. Now, I know the USGA and the RNA want to implement a rollback for professional golf, I think it's in 2028. First of all, your thoughts on that issue, and do you think with the PGA's resistance, that will make a difference?
Well, it's 2028. You're right. That's for the elite game, or the, you know, the professional golfers, 2030 for recreational. So you're exactly right. This is what I know. You know, right now, it's the most collaborative process that I've ever seen. I actually celebrate and thank the USGA for when we came back. Now, we had been against it before, right? We had our press releases in 2023. But as we talk to the 28 million golfers that we just referenced earlier, we have to listen to them, man. I mean, our pros are the ones who talk to those 28 million golfers, and they had some concerns of like, how much is this going to affect my enjoyment of the game? Is this going to make the game more expensive? And all we did is, you know, we went to the USGA, Mike Wan and Fred Perpall and Mark Darbin, right? And said, hey guys, we just talked to 28 million golfers and they have mentioned a couple things and we probably should start talking about that. And, you know, the USGA said, yeah, let's talk more about it. And we've had some great meetings with the PGA Tour, the DP Tour, all the recreational stakeholders in golf, the owners, the superintendents. And so that collaborative process is happening now. And like I said in the press conference, I think sometimes you can listen to respond and other times you can listen to learn. I really appreciate the process right now where everybody's listening to learn on behalf of the game. And I don't know what's going to happen. I just want golf to win. But I do appreciate that we're having this collaborative approach. It's awesome.
And you've been in the golf industry for years. So if they decide perhaps not to roll back the ball, I mean, what other measures do you think need to be done to battle the distance issue?
If they don't roll it back, is that what you said, Ann?
Yes.
If they don't roll it back, well, I think, you know, I think everybody agrees the ball can't go any farther. Right. Everybody agrees that rolling back, that's what causes some of the issues, I think, for all of those amateurs out there. I mean, think about it. You know, I'm playing a Pro V1 and then I lose it on the first hole, but then I find another Pro V1 and then I start playing with that. And is that conforming or not? Because you don't know how long that ball's been in that bush. So that's kind of crazy. So if they don't, if they do end up rolling it back, then, you know, we'll adjust and we're going to try like heck to make sure they understand the blind spot there. But I know they're listening very well. And if they don't roll it back, then the ball can't go any further. We don't think it should go further. We really don't. We just don't want it to go shorter.
All right. Let's talk Ryder Cup. I mean, I wish I had 3 hours with you, but we have to get all this in a very short segment here.
I'm talking fast, Ann. I'm talking as fast as I can.
I know. I love your energy. So, of course, the Ryder Cup at the end of September. Beth Page Black. Talk about how your team is preparing and what your expectations are for the Ryder Cup in New York.
Well, how about Keegan Bradley, right? I'm telling you, this guy loves the Ryder Cup. His dad's a PGA golf professional. He knows the course. He loves his players. I mean, I saw him at the past Champions Dinner this week. He loves being captain. You saw him in the press conference. You know, but I think what's really cool, you know, the crowds are going to be amazing. I mean, think about it. This is iconic. It's going to be epic. We're on this amazing golf course and we're right outside Manhattan. I mean, what is more American than that on a public golf course? And that's what really stirred us. And we knew we were going to do this. We just didn't want to start it until Bethpage opened. But the People's Perk, 3,000 tickets that are free, and we're surprising people in that whole area. The Metropolitan PGA is helping the PGA of America for us to give some tickets to people who wouldn't expect it. Maybe they've stood in line all day to try to play Bethpage. We're giving them to kids. We're giving them to church groups. I mean, it's amazing. And so we're really proud to tell everybody that this Ryder Cup is the People's Ryder Cup.
So it's going to be a Ryder Cup ticket giveaway. Can you give us some more details? When is this going to happen? And who's eligible?
Yeah, well, it's happening now. Like I said, we've got 3,000 tickets that we're handing out. And we've got, man, you could Google like some of the cool videos that have happened already. When we launched it, when Bethpage opened, I think last week sometime, it was raining. But the people who braved the rain to play that very first day that it opened, we literally on the second hole had an envelope on the flagstick. It said, open me. When they opened it, boom, they've got Ryder Cup tickets. And then we came out and interviewed him. So it's going to be things like that. There were some kids on the range. We gave them tickets. You'll see there's going to be even more activations that are going to just put a big smile on your face and warm your heart of the looks on these people's faces when they get tickets to the Ryder Cup. So I'm not going to tell you all the details, Ann, because I got to surprise you. It's awesome.
All right. Well, I mean, look, the tickets are very expensive this year. There's, you know, no secret to that. What, $255 for practice round, $749 for tournament days per day. You know, they're a lot more expensive than they were last 2 years ago at Marco Simone in Italy and at Ryder Cups previous.
Yeah, but, you know, a couple things. One, you know, it only comes around every 4 years domestically, right? World Series tickets were more expensive than that. They had a world, you know, they had a playoff game, World Series game in Yankee Stadium, right? And they were like $1,000. But remember this, those tickets, they get sold on the secondary market, right? We know that that happens all the time. And the last time I checked, those secondary markets, they don't write checks to PGA Reach Foundation. They don't help kids play golf. They don't save veterans' life like PGA Hope does. All we wanted to do is meet in the middle somewhere, raise our ticket prices so that we can have more money to give back to this game. Remember, the Ryder Cup's a global competition, and it's amazing. But at the end of the day, it's our fundraiser. We are a not-for-profit in every sense of the word, and the Ryder Cup allows us to grow the game and serve our members. So, yeah, they went up a little bit, but it was only because we could have more to give back to the game.
Don Ray, president of the PGA of America. I love your positive attitude and your energy. It's infectious.
Thanks, Ann. You're the best. I appreciate your show and have a great day.
Right now, we head to Erin Hills in Wisconsin, the site of the upcoming U.S. Women's Open. That is where Dr. Jeff Pablarski is, the Performance and Recovery Director for the USGA, getting ready to treat the competitors as they take on just a really challenging golf course, Erin Hills. And I remember I was there in 2017 when Erin Hills hosted the men's U.S. Open. It is a grueling test. And hey, Dr. Jeff, how's it going?
Doing great, Ann. It's 41 degrees here at Erin Hills, so it's a very brisk morning, and looking forward to a great week here at Erin Hills. It certainly is a bear of a golf course, and we were here in 2017, like you said, and just 8 years just flies, but it's going to be a great week.
Well, you've been there for a couple of days, and you're all set up. Give us a sense of what you have to bring in, all the equipment, and how all the logistics work.
Yeah, so being the Performance and Recovery Director, we have several modalities that we offer the players. We have doctors of chiropractic, physical therapists, athletic trainers, massage therapists, Normatec compression recovery systems, hyperbaric chamber, free ice baths, and infrared sauna. We kind of have all the modalities to assist all the players and also caddies we treat at these events too.
And so what percentage, you have 156 competitors who are entered in this U.S. Women's Open, and how many of those competitors would you say take advantage of all the treatment that your team offers?
You know, on average, we see about two-thirds of the field and maybe about four-fifths of the caddies. So we're up to like about 200 players and caddies coming through treatment, so we'll be very busy during the week for sure.
And so how many people are on your team?
We have 30 people, and we have people from Canada and Texas and Pennsylvania, wherever we've had these USGA events, because this is our 47th USGA championship, wherever we have these events, we recruit in those geographic areas. So we have a tremendous following of people from around the country that are on our team. Obviously, we have people from Wisconsin, too, on our team.
Now, does this equipment go from venue to venue, or do you have to bring it in locally?
Yeah, we have two sets of equipment, and a lot of my time is actually spent in FedEx and UPS offices, because we have, you know, I think it was about 25, 40-pound boxes that were delivered to Erin Hills. And then we take some of that equipment, and we ship it 2 to 3 days to Oakmont, which is our next championship in Pittsburgh next week.
So for those who might not know what a hyperbaric chamber is, can you describe it and let us know, you know, the benefits of it?
Yeah, you know, you're breathing 21% oxygen right now in the air. Everybody's doing that. When we put you in a chamber, which looks like a torpedo, it's actually pretty spacious. You go in there, and what it does is it hyper-saturates your body with oxygen. The more oxygen you have in your body, the quicker that you recover. So it's a great recovery tool and a very popular modality in the, we're calling it the PAR team. Instead of saying performance recovery, we'll call it the PAR team, but very, very popular modality that we have.
And so will the players go in this, like, after every round?
Yeah, we have players that go in it after the round, again, cleaning up. The more oxygen in the body, or inflammation you reduce, because inflammation doesn't like oxygen. So they do go after rounds, but they also go before rounds just to get some more oxygen up into the brain, and thoughts are a little bit better with that, and they get a little bit more clarity in their thought process with more oxygen in their body.
And so it really works. I mean, I have not tried it, but I'm going to have to try this.
Yeah. Certainly, yeah, it's very popular in professional sports. You know, the NFL, I think there's about 400 active units that are used in the NFL. Players buy in, and actually they sleep in the chambers 7 or 8 hours of just inducing more oxygen into the body.
So how long should you stay in there?
It's a one-hour treatment.
Oh, it's 1 hour. Okay. So before and after. So give us a sense of what the pros do, you know, day-to-day to prepare for their day at work. I mean, and then I'd love to hear what amateur golfers should do in terms
sure.
of fitness and yeah. strength, et cetera.
Yeah, so again, our title is that PAR team, performance and recovery. So performance, they'll come in before the round and prep the body to go out and play. You know, an average LPGA women's golfer club head speed is about 101 miles per hour. You know, that's nothing to fool around with. That's like throwing a fastball 100 miles an hour, or
sure.
throwing a football, you know, Tom Brady throwing a football 60 yards. It's the same mechanical forces in the body. So in our treatments, we like to prep the body, the golfer, for that movement, especially the drive. So it's about activating the body. You know, you have to activate the lower back and activate the glutes and activate the shoulder and the wrist and the mid back. So there's a lot of activation of the body, preparing it for the game. And then afterwards, that's the recovery component after they're walking 7-8 miles here. Cause again, this is the bare of a golf course and all that mechanical force from swinging. Now we got to clean up the body, reduce the inflammation, get them recovered, which is a very popular thing now in sports. You know, 30 years ago, if I was on your show, we wouldn't be talking about recovery. Now they're saying, you know, half the time that you're playing a sport, so if you're playing a round of golf for 5 hours, half of that time on a professional level, they're using recovery techniques. So it's about a 2-hour, 2.5-hour process to recover the players.
And what's involved in that recovery?
So we're back to what we're offering, whether it's hyperbarics, whether it's the Normatec compression, whether it's chiropractic adjustments, whether it's massage therapy, you know, whether it's a stretching technique, whether it's icing people, whether it's sitting in the ice bath. So they kind of go through all of those modalities after they play.
I love that. All right. And then, you know, obviously stretching is key. I mean, even when I'm not playing golf, I stretch every morning. I would be a different person if I didn't stretch. And it's only like a 15-20 minute stretch exercise that I do every morning. But, I mean, stretching is huge, right? And it should be done before and after.
Yes, exactly. You know, and it's a different type of stretch, Leanne. You know, years ago, you would hold the stretch for like a minute, 30 seconds. That really throw that idea out. It's all about that activation we were just talking about. You need to stretch the areas for 2 seconds and then repeat it. So if you were stretching your shoulder, you hold it for 2 seconds, 1, 2, and then you repeat it, 1, 2. So it's these fast bursts of flexibility because the swing is 1.53 seconds, right? About 2 seconds, a little less than 2 seconds. So your stretching for golf should be about 2 seconds, but repeat the movement over and over again instead of holding it for 30 seconds or a minute. So for the viewers, think about just doing 2 second stretches, but doing it multiple times over and over.
And you do this before you play and after.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Before and after. Again, recovery is a very, very big part of performance because you don't want to show up at the golf course the next day and your back is sore and your knee is sore. You're just not going to perform as well. You got to clean all of that soreness, all that inflammation out of the body, kind of be pain-free the next day, and then you're going to perform better. So especially playing 4 rounds in a row at Erin Hills, I mean, we had a caddy in yesterday. The guy just walked the course to get the measurements. He came in, he was huffing and puffing. His knees were already hurting, you know, an older caddy. And we kind of told him the story. And he's like, wow, I didn't even know this was available at these events. I said, yeah, the USGA does a great job. And not only what we're doing, we have a wellness den where the players could go in and relax. You know, we have a full gym, a 40 by 40 foot tent that we board equipment in so the players could use weight training for strength training. You know, we have a lot of modalities. They brought in a manicurist and pedicurist for the players. You know, so a lot of different things. And I'm hearing from the players that the USGA does the best presentation for the players at their championships. And we hear that over and over again over the years.
I love that. They really do take care of the players and the caddies, which I think is just as important. And I love the fact you said there's like a Zen room where players can go in there and just, you know, chill out and get their mind ready and get calm before the round.
Yeah, they're calling it the Wellness Den. It's actually about 50 feet or 50 yards from the performance and recovery tent. I went in there and they have nice relaxing couches and nice music and it's different types of lighting to just kind of calm you down. And I could see that being very effective, you know, trying to slow your body down when you get to that first tee so you're not really all amped up. So it's another great thing. We've never seen that at events anywhere else in the world, but the USGA did put this wellness den together.
You mentioned, Jeff, that the women have about, 101 club head speed?
Yeah. Yes, on a driver, yes.
Okay, so what would be the difference in treatment, say, with the women pros compared to the guys?
Yeah, so guys are about, you know, PGA Tour is about 121, so it's a 20-mile-an-hour difference. You know, the strength, you know, we always say this, from the waist down, guys and girls are about the same strength. That's why if you look at the Olympics on a 100-yard sprint, the times are actually very similar. But from the waist up, the females are about 40% as strong as a male. And that's a big thing to look at because what happens with the female, they try to catch up a lot because they don't have that upper body strength and they'll excessively use their wrist or their elbow and their shoulder. And then all of a sudden injuries start occurring in the upper body because of the strength differential. That's a
wow.
Big difference.
It's big difference. I mean, there's a big difference, yeah. But, you know, the women are just incredible. The length that they get on their drives. When you're not working at these USGA championships, I know you run your own chiropractic facility in Amityville. You're a professor. Your resume is incredible. And quickly, you are also involved with a podcast, The Ride to the Ryder Cup with the great Frank Darby. Give me a quickie on that one. What are you doing with that?
Yeah, it's a 35-week show. It's called The Road to the Ryder Cup. It's sponsored by the Tunnel to Towers, and we're doing the A to Z of the Ryder Cup, from player interviews to media interviews to state people to politicians, you name it. We're going to talk about the Ryder Cup for the next 35 weeks.
Hey, continued success, Jeff. Have a great week at the U.S. Women's Open. Thanks for getting up early for us.
All right, have a good day.
It is my pleasure to welcome in Nicklas Callaway, son of the late Eli Callaway. Eli, the founder of Callaway Golf and so much more. And Nicklas co-edited and co-published a new book titled The Unconquerable Game, My Life in Golf and Business by Eli Callaway. Hey, great to have you on the show finally, Nicklas Callaway. It's always a pleasure.
And it's great to be with you. We've known each other a long time, both on and off the links.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I've had the pleasure of not only knowing your father, but interviewing him in his Callaway Golf office in Carlsbad, California, for my show on the Golf Channel. And just a fascinating man. And he sent me the Big Bertha, then the Great Big Bertha. And I'm still using, as I mentioned, believe it or not, the Callaway Steelhead Wood. So my connection to your dad goes way back.
Yes. Well, everyone who met Eli never forgot him, and everyone has an Eli story. So I want to hear some of your Eli stories.
Well, he was just a Southern gentleman, as you know, you can read his voice from the book, and very smart and wise. And you know, my favorite part of this book, The Unconquerable Game, My Life in Golf and Business, Eli Callaway, are the business lessons and the wisdom that he so eloquently and seemingly easily portrayed throughout the entire book. And we'll get into some of those pearls of wisdom. But talk about the process of putting this book together, because I know he started to write this memoir back in the 90s.
Yes, I think he was working on it when you interviewed him for your book, right? A Passion for Golf. I have been a publisher all my life, and he had such an amazing life that in the last years of his life, in the first glory days of Callaway Golf after they went public, and there were many business autobiographies being written at the time, Sam Walton, Lee Iacocca, The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump. And I felt that Eli was a seminal figure in 20th century American business. And of course, he transformed the golf industry. And I had the great privilege to observe him throughout my lifetime. And so I convinced him that he should sit down and write his life story, which spanned nine decades of the 20th century. It was a unique life. And someone who's read the book, actually the founder of Whole Foods, said, you know, it's a very rare thing to transform one industry in your life, but I've never heard of anyone who transformed three industries. And I think that that is true. So he started it. He worked with four different writers in search of someone who could capture his voice. He passed away in 2001. Finally, he worked with Larry Dorman, the head golf writer of the New York Times. But when he passed away, it was in, like a jigsaw puzzle in 1,000 pieces. And it remained that way for a generation. During COVID, I decided that so many of the things he accomplished, that he cared about, that he stood for, would be valuable and relevant and timely. And boy, are they. So anyone who reads or listens to the book, and we'll talk about the AI audiobook, I think we'll feel almost as if this was ripped out of today's headlines.
Well, so, I can't believe he passed away in 2001. It's just, that's a long time. And he seems to me so ever present. Callaway Golf is still such an iconic brand. But why do you think it took so long for you to decide, okay, let's finish this memoir?
We tried to get Larry to finish it for years. And interestingly, he finally said, I can't do it. Eli was so meaningful to me and changed. He was the most important man in my life. And every time I try to finish the assignment with the editorial distance that, of course, I've been trained to preserve as a great journalist at the New York Times, he says, I can't do it. I'm overcome with the emotion of thinking of him and missing him. And we still hear this again and again. You're one of them. He had such a powerful personal and professional impact on so many people and on an industry. It's still felt today. So that's really why it just stayed there. But I inherited his personal archives during COVID, and it was tens of thousands of documents. And that made me realize, as I did a deep dive, that I had never, I learned things about him that neither I nor anyone knew. And the book is filled with surprises and discoveries, almost like a breadcrumb trail that he left behind. And when I read in those massive archives, I realized there was a great story. And Diana Duval, who was his last assistant at Callaway Golf, you may remember her. She is
Sure
now head
do.
of real estate at the Cabot Collection, and a significant has gone on to be a significant si significant executive in the golf industry, having gotten her start with him. We decided it was time to put it together. So that led me down a detective. It was a became a detective story, really.
Well, your dad led an incredible life, Nicholas, as you mentioned, many lives, many careers. He had a very successful career in the textile business and the wine business before he even got into the golf business at the age of 63.
Yes, he said, I've led four lives, four careers, four wives, and each one was fascinating. And he tells all of those stories. But I just wanted to say that he left behind the impression that it was all easy and that it was all just going from success to success. But one of the great messages of the book that I think everyone will find valuable is the failures, in fact, and the risks that he took against all odds. He said that by the time he started Callaway Golf, he had experienced so much failure that he was no longer afraid of failure and that it liberated him. So it is a story of persistence. And what do you do when you fail, when you get fired, when you confront crisis, either financial, ethical, or moral in your life? And that's why it really is a book for everyone.
It really is. The lessons are incredible. He started Callaway Golf in 82. He was 63 years old. He did not need another career, another startup. He was living the good life. But I love this quote. He said, "Everything is determined by a person's attitude, how they react to an event or a situation. I don't think about my age in terms of being over the hill or ready to be put out to pasture. In fact, I don't think of age at all, except in terms of the knowledge and experience that can only be acquired with age."
Yes, indeed. And he also says in the book, I started Callaway Golf when I was 63, which astonishes everyone. But he said, I didn't think I was 63. I thought I was 36.
I
So.
love how, he makes an analogy between starting a business and golf, saying you're either a mechanical player in golf or a feel player. I mean, he idolized the great Bobby Jones, and your dad was quite a golfer. And he said in quotes, "The feel player gets a brief overall impression of the situation, chooses their club, steps up, and just swings. He's the ultimate feel player in business." Your dad had a general sense that the golf club industry was a sleepy business in need of a wake-up call. So he said, "I went all in and took a big swing."
Yeah, well, as we know, golf, the game, is a great metaphor, right? For life. And so that thought about the difference between the field player and the mechanical player applies not only to golf, but to business and to life. He was the ultimate field player in life.
Talk about when the Big Bertha first came about. There's a great story about he took you golfing and your reaction to the name.
So what people don't realize is that by the time he started Callaway Golf at 63, he had been playing golf for 60 of those 63 years. I had the experience of growing up. I learned to walk on a golf course holding my mother's and father's hands. So when he started Callaway Golf, it made perfect sense to me because he loved golf more than anything. But it was a little a novelty company of hickory over steel shafts. But I used to go out and play with him near the headquarters of Callaway Golf, and we went to Del Mar one day. He had a big tour bag with a towel over it filled with prototypes, and he pulled this club out. It had nothing on it, but it was huge. And he said, "Nikki, see this club? This is going to be the biggest selling golf club in the world a year from now, and it's going to change the game. And I've given it a name, and I want to know what you think." Now, he was famous for playing with words and names. And I said, "Okay, lay it on me." And he said, "I'm going to call it the Big Bertha." And I said, "I think that's the worst name for a product I've ever heard." And he said, "Well, you're wrong. But let me tell you why you're wrong." He said, "First of all, it has a great story." And he had remembered from World War II, when he was a soldier, the World War I cannon, the Big Bertha that could shoot a ball farther than anything else. And he said, "It has a story behind it." And he believed in the power of that everything was storytelling. And he said, "Besides, remember, the product makes the name. The name doesn't make the product." And I said, "I still think it's the worst name that I've ever heard. I thought it actually was rather sexist." And he said, "Well, why don't you try it out and then tell me what you think?" So I did. I stepped up. It made a really weird sound on impact, not just the fact that it was a metal head. The club head flew off the shaft, dribbled down the fairway about 20 yards farther than the ball did. And he said, "Well, we still got a few gluing problems, but I promise you it's going to be the biggest selling club in the world a year from now, and it's going to change the game of golf forever." And sure enough, he was right on all counts.
What a great story. And your dad predicted it would revolutionize the game. And as you said, he was right. It debuted the Big Bertha driver at the 1991 PGA Show in Orlando. And within a year, it became the best-selling golf club in the world. And
Were you
sales
there?
grew to
Were you there,
54
Anne?
million.
Were you there at that PGA?
Oh, yes.
Do you have any memories of
Oh, yes. In
it?
fact, your father gave me the great. I still have it. I still have it. And as I say, I still use the steelhead Callaway. And the Callaway manufacturers, the sales reps, when I play in these celebrity tournaments or these charity events, they look at me like, "We do have your new technology." But it's all those original clubs that I love so much. And, with little advertising, mostly word of mouth, it really kicked off the age of stainless steel drivers and oversized clubhouse. You can't really talk enough about the impact of the Big Bertha, what it did for the golf industry.
Well, think about it. Overall, there are very few products that you can name of any kind that change an entire industry and a lifestyle. And that is one example. Of course, maybe the great example of our time in America is Apple. But Ely was, after a lifetime as a New York corporate executive, made this huge leap to California at the same time as the birth of Silicon Valley, of Napa food and wine revolution. And he became a pioneering late 20th century California lifestyle brand creator with his golf clubs. It's quite
He
a story.
stuck to his guns from a business perspective, used mostly his instincts, Nicholas. Again, I love the wisdom about business that he shares throughout the entire book. He said in quotes, "I strongly believe that you should not have a business plan. It's too easy to get discouraged because if you realize what you're up against, you'll never take the risk."
I hope that will be heartening to entrepreneurs because it is so true. And he says that raising money, even for Callaway Golf and in general in business, is the hardest thing. And if you think of someone like him who ran one of the biggest companies in the world, and if that's hard, then so this is both a manual, a how-to of business, and also an encouragement for anyone who's in business, startup, medium or giant corporation.
Nicholas Calloway, co-editor and publisher of The Unconquerable Game, My Life in Golf and Business, Illy Calloway joins us. And Nicholas, I just love this book so much because of all the wisdom, the business wisdom in the book that your father distributes throughout in such an eloquent Southern gentleman kind of way. But talk about your childhood. What was it like being the son of Illy Calloway?
Well, I first knew him as a golfer. Everyone is astonished when they learn that he started Callaway Golf at the age of 63 in 1982 after two other careers. But it made perfect sense to me. I learned to walk holding his hand and my mother's hand, who was also an excellent golfer. So that was my first image of him. But of course, he at that time was rising the New York corporate world, running one of the largest corporations in the world and the largest textile company, Burlington Industries. So I thought of him as the ultimate, master of the corporate universe. But by the later in his life, and we learn in the book why he was forced to make a huge change due to a crisis in midlife that actually liberated him to give up everything, to move to California, to become a brand creator, a pioneering brand creator, first in wine, then in golf. So as an adult, I had a chance to see him, on the leading edge of American startup culture, which we usually think of as, 18 and 20-year-old kids in a garage. Well, he did it in a garage, but he was 62.
I know. Yeah, he bought 50% of Hickory Stick for 400,000 in 1982, became president and CEO of the company in 83, and then bought the rest for 400K a year later. And all totaled, I read where he put 2.8 million in it all together and did not pay himself for what, the first 8 years. I mean, he was truly an entrepreneur and had certain kind of thoughts and wisdom about what it really meant to be an entrepreneur.
Yes. And so you asked what it was like growing up. Well, I had an impression that, he had everything under control. But doing this book and doing a deep dive into his personal archives, I fully realized that it was all, on the edge, almost throughout his life. In fact, if he wasn't on the edge, he generally went and walked out onto the edge. He had a brilliant, as an entrepreneur needs to, willingness, appetite for risk, but also a very reasoned sense of how much risk to take and knowing how to balance that.
He did say about that in quotes, "I guess I'm just built in such a way that I look at more of the opportunity than the risks in any situations." He said, "I can see what others can't. I believe that most successful entrepreneurs have that in common. Another man's fear is our opportunity."
And that defined him. And he did that he was an eternal optimist, but he was not reckless, at least not in his business life. And he so it was well researched and calculated risk, but an appetite to pursue opportunity before other people did. He had vision. He saw way ahead, and he had incredible persistence to turn his vision into an idea, into a plan, into a product, and into a success. And that spectrum, of course, is the definition of an entrepreneur. It's a rare combination of skills, and he was brilliant at it.
What do you think your father would think about Callaway now?
Well, he'd be very proud that this, as he said, itty-bitty company that he started is a multi-billion-dollar global company that changed an industry. He was a great popularizer, and his whole belief was in bringing pleasure through a great, innovative, highest quality product to the largest audience. So I think in that sense, he would be thrilled.
Well, I have to say, I had my second hole in one on February 2nd of this year, my father's heavenly birthday. And
Wow.
it was with the seven wood, the
The
original Callaway
heaven,
steelhead, the heaven wood.
AKA Heavenwood.
And when I wrote Callaway, the CEO, and told them about my hole in one with the original heaven wood, they sent me two new seven woods
Oh, great.
to commemorate the occasion and so that I could talk about it at my charity golf event. And it just Callaway still to this day is just so close to my heart. And
That's
you
wonderful.
had said that you thought that your dad, his memory was forgotten. You mentioned that several times that Illy Callaway has been forgotten. Do you really believe that?
Well, not entirely. There's, I think, millions of people devoted to his products, and so many people still know him. But think, we have a full generation. So there's a lot of people who didn't know that there was an Ely Calloway. And I wanted to mention that because he was unforgettable, and his story was, and his voice, as you know, was unique. In order to bring him back, we've completed his life story in words, and we've brought him back in his own voice, because yesterday we released the world's first AI-enhanced, posthumously narrated by the author, audiobook. And
That's incredible. Your dad's
I'm so glad he's back, and I hope you are too.
Nicholas Calloway, co-editor and publisher of The Unconquerable Game, My Life in Golf and Business, Illy Calloway. Thanks so much for joining us, Nicholas Calloway.
And thank you so much. That's just wonderful. And you have such a great radio voice. It's very inviting and welcoming.
My thanks to Don Ray, to Dr. Jeff Poplarski, to Nicholas Calloway, and to Mike Goodsell in production. As Helen Keller once said, life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Here's to great adventure. Be kind, be safe, and I look forward to talking with you next time, right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaCorey.